Welcome to the Science Podcast for November 1st, 2013. I'm Christy Hamilton.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, we have three neuroscience stories to go along with a special issue on the heavily connected brain, including new insight into the role of scar tissue in spinal cord injury, treating depression with deep brain stimulation, and from the special issue, neural predisposition to learning music and language.
So, you know, there's a lot of talk about individualized medicine these days. We could also think about individualized education.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
When we learn something new, our brain changes both in function and structure. This change is known as neuroplasticity and happens differently across individuals. Focusing in on music and speech, Robert Zatori examines the idea that variability in people's learning abilities is influenced by their initial brain wiring. That is, it may be possible to predict how well you learn a new instrument or pick up a new language based on predisposing factors.
The idea that the brain changes in response to learning has been around for quite a while and has been strongly supported by a lot of different evidence. And what we're looking at now is the idea that those changes may not be identical in every individual. And so we're trying to understand what makes those differences across different people and why some people may have predisposition or a propensity for learning in some particular domains as compared to other domains. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that by looking at brain imaging results.
You focus specifically on speech and music learning. Why do you call them the most complex and characteristically human auditory motor functions?
One of the things that makes music interesting is that it really touches upon every aspect of cognition. So if you're thinking about something simple, like you hear a tune and then later you sing it back, well, that's incredibly complicated because you have to perceive the sounds, you have to encode them somewhere in your nervous system, then you have to retrieve them at a later point, then you have to organize your vocal system, the muscles of your larynx and so forth, they all have to be coordinated to produce the sound, and then it also involves things like memory, obviously, and involves emotion as well. So that makes it very complex. And then, if you think about it, the only other way that we humans use sound in such a complicated way would be speech, where we also have a very complex motor ability to make sounds, and those sounds encode meaning and allow us to convey information and ideas and thoughts and emotions from one person to another, and in fact across generations, which is what creates human culture.
Looking at a deeper level, what kinds of changes happen in our brain during music and speech learning?
Well, so the answer to that question, of course, depends on the specific type of learning that you're talking about. So if you're talking, for instance, about learning to distinguish the sounds of speech, if you're learning a new language, for instance, then you may get changes going on in the auditory part of the brain. But if you're talking about learning how to pronounce those sounds, then you might get changes that involve a broader network that would involve both auditory regions and motor regions, for example. Mm-hmm. And the same might be the case for music. But what is remarkable is that those changes, although we can measure them and they certainly occur, are not identical across all individuals. So some people have greater changes, some people have smaller changes.
So in terms of anatomy, how is the brain changing physically?
Yeah, so that's something that's really quite interesting that has only been appreciated, oh, I would say in the past decade or so. It used to be thought that the anatomy of the adult brain was more or less fixed. And if it changed, it was only changing in terms of atrophy or degeneration or some disease process. But it's now recognized that any kind of learning, if it's prolonged enough and if it's intense enough, will result in specific changes both to measures of cortical structure, mm-hmm. as well as to measures of the white matter. So the white matter contains the fibers that interconnect different cortical structures. And we can see that, for example, if we look at people who have musical training, mm-hmm. we do see changes in the cortex, in the areas that control the activity of the hands, for instance, mm-hmm. which makes sense because if you learn to play an instrument, you have to learn to to control that instrument with very refined motor controls. But we also see that those changes are accompanied by anatomical changes in the connection between the motor cortices of the left and of the right hemisphere.
So as you mentioned, not everyone learns at an identical pace. Some people pick up music faster, others pick up language faster. So what evidence is there for the argument that predisposing factors influence our learning abilities in these two areas?
Right. So this is the core of the argument that I developed in this paper. Typically, most people, including myself, have tended to just look at the group and say, okay, there's a net change in a group of, let's say, 20 people. We train them, and we see that there's a particular region that is increased. Okay, great. But it turns out that some people learn much more quickly than others. And so we started thinking, well, what could that be? And other labs have done so as well. In one particular example I can give you, we had people listening to very, very small pitch changes in a melody, so they were hard to hear. And some people learned this really very well, and others didn't, even though none of them had any particular musical training. So then we looked at the brain scan that was obtained prior to the beginning of training. And what we could see is that some people naturally seemed to have a better response in their auditory cortex to those fine-grained pitch changes compared to other people. And those persons are the ones who then went on to learn more quickly. Mm-hmm. So that suggests to us that there are some individuals who, despite not having any particular prior training in music, just seem to have a predisposition. Their brains are more prepared, are better able to encode those particular aspects of sound, which are then very important for learning music. And similar phenomena have been found in speech domain. So if you look, for instance, at the connectivity between different areas of the brain that are involved in language function, you just look at how interconnected they are. And this is true both with what we call functional connectivity, which is the temporal coupling of brain activity, and also structural connectivity, which is the white matter that connects those particular regions. We see that some people have greater connectivity than others, and indeed those are the people who then can learn more quickly certain aspects of speech.
So these studies primarily focus on how fast people are learning music, how fast they're picking up tones. What about the outcome? So if one person has a better inclination for learning music and another person doesn't, if you vary the training, can they come to the same outcome? Can they both be at the same level in the end?
Mm-hmm. That's really an excellent question, and I think it's one that is so far not answered. So in some of the experiments, we indeed have seen that the difference across individuals really has to do with the amount of time that it takes and not with the ultimate attainment. In other words, everybody eventually learns whatever it is that we're teaching them. It's just some people take longer. However, in other experiments, we do see that some people kind of reach a certain plateau and don't really go beyond that, whereas others, you know, continue to learn. My expectation is, in fact, that some brain features are going to be more related to the amount of time that it takes to establish new learning, while other brain features may be more in terms of imposing a limit on how well can you do.
Mm-hmm. So my chances of becoming the next Mozart might be predetermined.
Well, you know, I don't want to make it seem like I'm talking about some kind of biological destiny here, mm-hmm. because what we don't know is, you know, what is the source of this individual variability that we see. And for all we know, it has a lot to do with the type of stimulation you may have received, for instance, early in childhood. It's almost certainly the case as well that a lot depends on the sort of epigenetic processes that may occur, perhaps during childhood or perhaps during adulthood as well. And it doesn't mean that I can take a brain scan and tell you, you know, what abilities you're going to have and what career you should choose. However, it might turn out to be useful if we can tell what a person's strengths or weaknesses might be. Because different people have different brains, it may turn out that different people require different types of training to achieve the same goal. And that's a very interesting idea that might have applications for pedagogy, for example, or maybe for rehabilitation of patients who've had kind of damage or disorder. If we can start to find a way to make different types of training more specifically geared towards mm-hmm. individuals. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about individualized medicine these days, but we could also think about individualized education, individualized training, individualized rehabilitation approaches for people who've suffered some damage.
So what's next? What more does the science community have to do to kind of understand what the actual source of this variability is?
Yeah, well, understanding the source, I think, is going to be quite difficult because when you're talking about human beings, it's very difficult to control all the different aspects of their life that they've had prior to the time that they appear in your laboratory. So that's going to be tricky. Now, there are ways that we can do this. We can try to select people, for example, who maybe have had different kinds of early childhood experiences and see if that makes a difference. Mm-hmm. It might be interesting if anyone can find genetic markers to start to look at some of those. But of course, these same questions can also be addressed in animal models where you can control things like the genetics or the environment much, much better than you possibly ever could in humans. In the human domain, I think what we can do is we can start to have more sophisticated understandings of these different characteristics that we're measuring in the brain.
All right. Well, Robert Satori, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Robert Satori writes about predispositions and plasticity in music and speech learning in this week's issue.
Depression remains a puzzling disease. Some medications work for some people. Electroshock therapy works for some people. These treatments are broad, bathing the whole brain in a chemical or electrical stimulation, and they don't always work. Emily Underwood spoke to many neuroscientists looking to target depression's underlying neural circuits with deep brain stimulation. She talked with me about their progress and what's on the road ahead.
To get deep brain stimulation for depression to qualify for one of these trials, you have to belong to this small, well, around 10 to 30% of people with depression who don't respond to any treatments at all. So you have to have tried many different kinds of drugs and electroconvulsive therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, and nothing works. So these people are at a higher risk of suicide. And to participate in the trial, they have to commit to, first of all, getting these electrodes implanted in their brains, but they also have to commit to being monitored for long periods of time and sometimes even moving to a new city. So the surgery itself lasts about 4 hours, and it involves drilling two holes in the skull and inserting long electrodes deep into the brain tissue. After that's done, they implant a battery below the clavicle and switch on the current, and it acts kind of like a pacemaker.
Is someone who's had the surgery always getting stimulation to that area?
Yeah, exactly. So it's continuous stimulation.
I read in your story that the person getting the surgery is actually awake during this?
Yeah, for parts of the surgery, at least. They want to be able to monitor how emotions are changing as they move the electrodes around. The clinician will actually talk to the patient as the surgery is going on.
So that helps them maybe target things a little bit better?
Yeah. If they don't see any response, they might move the electrode by a millimeter and see if that changes how the person feels.
Okay. Though many people have anecdotally reported success with this treatment, there hasn't been much in the way of randomized control trials. But for the few that there have been, were the results promising?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can imagine why this is. Nobody wants to get deep brain stimulation surgery and then not have the current be applied. So despite that difficulty, there are now some large clinical trials going on where a person gets the surgery, but there may be a period of time where the current is not turned on. Unfortunately, the first trial that is soon to be published showed no effect after 4 months beyond the placebo effect.
One of the things that's been debated about this surgery is where in the brain to target specifically. And I think you put this in a very interesting light in your article. It almost seems to depend on which part of depression the researcher thinks is most important to treat, where they end up targeting the electrodes. Can you talk about how these different takes on depression have led to different approaches to deep brain stimulation?
The researchers I've talked to, it's important to emphasize that the fact that they stimulate different regions doesn't necessarily mean that these are in competition. Many different parts of a complex circuit in the brain could be contributing to depression, and different parts could break for different reasons. Helen Mayberg, for instance, who targets a brain region called Area 25, thinks that abnormal activity in this region really alters all the other parts of the depression circuit and really acts as a hub, and that when you normalize activity in this region, you sort of allow the rest of the brain to act normally and go about its business. So that's one model. Another take comes from researchers who focus more on parts of the brain that are related to reward, and especially anticipating reward. This is something that a lot of people with depression don't have. They don't enjoy the things that they used to, but they most importantly don't look forward to good things happening. So researchers who target those parts of the brain that are involved in processing reward think that reward is really key.
You talk about some of the reasons why Mayberg has focused on Area 25. Can you talk about some of the evidence for that?
Sure. Area 25 is a region tucked below the corpus callosum, which is a broad band of nerve fibers that connects the left and right hemispheres of the brain. In healthy people, studies going back a decade show that when a healthy person thinks of a sad event, like a grandmother dying or taking care of a friend with AIDS, that this brain region sort of lights up, its activity increases. In depressed people who do not respond to the common antidepressant drug Prozac, this region does not change its activity, so it seems like it's kind of stuck. So that, in addition to studies showing that certain types of brain cells aren't as healthy in this region in people with depression, and imaging studies, a lot of evidence has pointed to this region as a potential important target.
Some people are taking a very different tact on trying to narrow down the targets for treating depression, and they're using mouse models. Can you talk about some of that work?
Yeah. So a fairly recent tool called optogenetics allows researchers to manipulate specific neurons to activate them with light. That is not ethical to do in people, so they do these studies in mice. One example of how this tool is being used is a group at Mount Sinai who's using optogenetics to stimulate just the very end of nerves that come from the prefrontal cortex, which is associated with decision-making and sort of higher-level processing, to the nucleus accumbens, which is associated with reward. And what they found is that just by stimulating the very ends of these neurons, they can reverse the symptoms of depression in mice. Now, they create depressed mice. Obviously, mice aren't depressed, but they can recreate certain symptoms of depression by exposing mice to chronic stress. And in this case, the stress is a bigger, meaner mouse that it feels threatened by for a while.
With this technique, you know, looking very carefully at which neurons are involved in mice, are they able to answer the bigger question, which is, why does electrical stimulation work to resolve depression in some people, and how might it actually work when we start to be more specific about our targets?
This is why the work in optogenetics is so important. Neurons can excite or inhibit one another depending on the type, and different levels of electric stimulation can actually inhibit or excite a neuron, so it gets really complicated. Using optogenetics to look at this on a cellular level may help deep brain stimulation researchers get a clearer sense of what's actually going on when they zap the brain.
The story really paints a picture of a field in transition where we have new tools for experimenting and then also maybe new tools for treatment. What are the next steps?
So hopefully putting these different techniques and approaches together will help develop drugs or therapies that are a lot more specific and have fewer side effects than we get from bathing the whole brain in chemicals or using electricity on a broad area. So that's the goal. But obviously we need to wait and watch for the results of these clinical trials.
Emily Underwood, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Underwood is a staff writer for Science. She writes about tracing the neural circuitry underlying depression this week.
The key players of scar formation in the spinal cord are astrocytes, star-shaped glial cells that help repair lesions following an injury. Although we tend to think of scarring as bad, it turns out there may actually be some benefit to this fibrous tissue. When comparing lesion development in mice, Jonas Friesen and colleagues found that recovery was poor in mice lacking the neural stem cells that produce astrocytes. I spoke with Friesen about his findings and how they may be used to improve spinal cord injury recovery.
The role of the heart tissue is complex, but it has mainly been implicated in inhibiting regeneration. However, we now show that one distinct component of the scar generated by neural stem cells is necessary for limiting the injury and also for supporting the survival of nerve cells close to the lesion.
So as a bit of background, how does the body typically respond to a spinal cord lesion or injury at the cellular level?
Yeah, so there are several different cell types that contribute to the generation of scar tissue at the spinal cord injury. So what has been by far most studied through the years is the scar tissue formed by supporting or glial cells called astrocytes. So this is often referred to as the glial scar or the astrocytic scar. And these astrocytes derive from two different sources. One is that there are many of these supporting cells in the intact nervous system, and many of them start dividing to generate more of the same after a lesion. But actually, the largest number of astrocytes derive from another cell source, and that's from a very small population of neural stem cells which are present in the adult spinal cord. So these neural stem cells in the intact tissue do not really do anything. They don't produce any other cell types, but in response to injury, they generate the majority of the scar-forming glial cells. There's also another component of scar tissue, which is connective tissue type, which is similar to what you find in most other organs in the body, which consists of connective tissue cells or fibroblasts, and they derive from pericytes, perivascular cells. So these are the three main origins of scar tissue in the injured spinal cord.
Okay, so there are these resident neural stem cells that give rise to the majority of new astrocytes, making the glial scar in the injured spinal cord. And in this study, you compared two groups of mice, one with normal glial scar generation and another with the cell types responsible for generating the glial scar knocked out. What differences did you find between the control and experimental groups 3 days after injury?
Yeah, so what we did was to very specifically turn off the possibility of the neural stem cells to divide to generate new cells. So we didn't actually blast or destroy these cells. Remain there, they just couldn't generate any progeny that could generate scar tissue. So it takes several days for these cells to divide in the normal situation and give rise to the scar tissue. So short after the injury, the only difference is that we don't see any proliferation of the stem cells in the animals where we have blocked this cell division, whereas in the control animals, there's very vigorous proliferation of these normally rather dormant stem cells.
What about after 9 to 14 weeks of recovery? What differences did you find between the groups then?
Yes, so with time, the differences became more and more apparent between the two groups. So in intact animals, a very dense scar tissue forms at the lesion, which gradually contracts over time to reduce the size of the lesion. But when we analyzed animals where we had blocked the proliferation of the neural stem cells and their participation in scar formation, we found that there were large holes often in the lesions, and that the spinal cords were thinner. And when we followed individual animals by repeated magnetic resonance imaging, we found that starting at about 3 weeks after the lesion, their injuries started to expand. They had developed much larger injuries than the original lesion, whereas the control animals had a contraction of the lesion. And we also found that the spinal cords were thinner in the animals where we did not have the neural stem cell response.
Okay, so the experimental mice had larger holes in the lesion, thinner spinal cords, and a greater area of damaged tissue. What kind of consequences did these experimental mice encounter then?
Yes, so what we found was that the gradual expansion of the lesions and in the absence of proper scar formation resulted in the severance of additional spinal cord axonal tracts, so additional nerve fibers that were injured originally became injured when the lesion was expanding. We also found that one major reason why the spinal cord was thinner in the absence of the scar formation was that there was a very pronounced neuronal loss in that, and that the scar tissue actually is a major source of survival factors for neurons.
So does scarring tend to have more of a negative implication in spinal cord injuries?
Yes, so the scar tissue has been studied for more than 100 years, and it has mainly been implicated in having a negative effect on the outcome of spinal cord injury. Here, by studying one distinct component of the scar tissue that is generated by the neural stem cells, we can clearly say that this particular component of the scar tissue is not attractive to block or to inhibit its formation. But it will, of course, be interesting to study the other components of the scar tissue.
Does this suggest that current therapies trying to suppress scarring may actually find greater benefit by augmenting this response after injury?
There have been many suggestions that it would be beneficial to block or reduce the formation of scar tissue in the injured spinal cord, but I think our study highlights that this is really rather complex, and our study highlights that this is actually attractive to perhaps consider increasing the generation of progeny from the neural stem cells. And this then is a little bit parallel to a completely different line of research where many different research groups have transplanted neural stem cells or other stem cell types to the injured spinal cord and found beneficial effects. And what our study perhaps suggests is that an alternative to transplanting cells could be to modulate the response of the endogenous resident neural stem cells, which are present in the spinal cord.
All right. Well, Jonas Friesen, thanks for talking with me.
Yeah. Thanks, Christy. Nice talking to you.
Jonas Friesen and colleagues write about the role of scar formation following spinal cord injury in this week's issue.
This Week in Science. On the site this week, you can read about the evolution of one of the youngest neutron stars known. Also in the research section, there's a report on reconstructing the microbial diversity of the near-extinct biome, tall grass prairie soils. In a news-focused story this week, Adrian Cho describes an experiment aimed at narrowing the identity of dark matter to a yes or no question. You can check out all these stories and more at www.sciencemag.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, Science Now, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on snakes on the brain. So this new finding raises a really interesting question. How much time did our primate ancestors spend thinking about snakes? But let's start with a more basic question. How long have snakes and mammals coexisted?
Well, the first snakes slithered through the forests of the supercontinent Gondwana about 100 million years ago. And they weren't very friendly to our tiny rodent-sized mammalian ancestors. At first, they squeezed the life out of them. And then about 40 million years later, they started injecting them with venom. So snakes were really one of the first and most persistent threats to our ancestors.
The idea here is that these persistent predators actually shaped important parts of our ancestors. What did they do to us, and is there any evidence for it from an evolutionary perspective?
Well, the idea is that we had to evolve to somehow avoid these snakes. Otherwise, you know, our ancestors were going to go extinct. And one of the things that at least this one researcher believes happened is that we evolved more forward-facing eyes to give us a better vision. And also, we enlarged these visual centers that are deep within our brains that are specialized for picking out specific features in the world around us. Obviously, you'd want to detect that snake so it didn't bite you. And so her idea, which she calls the snake detection theory, and she first proposed it in 2006, is basically that these early interactions with snakes actually shaped who we are today.
So how can you show that the snakes were the key to, say, our eyes or to these enlarged visual centers?
Well, some of the evidence before this new study was that there are some rare primates who have never encountered venomous snakes, and they seem to have poorer vision than other primates.
In the new study, they bring in the neuroscientists.
Right.
What were they able to find about this?
Well, the neuroscientists focused on this region of the brain, which is called the pulvinar, which is this cluster of neurons in an evolutionarily very ancient part of the brain called the thalamus. And these neurons, these pulvinar neurons, are believed to help direct our attention using our eyes to recognize a specific threat. And interestingly, primates have much bigger pulvinars than other animals, and certain parts of the pulvinar are even specific to primates. So you would imagine that there was this part of our brain that was very specific to detecting snakes, this might be it.
They now have a structure to look at. When they took a look at the neurons and the structure, were they snake responsive?
Well, they looked at a couple of captive-born macaque monkeys that had never encountered snakes before, and they inserted electrodes into their pulvinars, and then they showed them a series of pictures, some pictures of snakes, some pictures of other macaques looking at them in a very threatening way, and some just sort of neutral expressions, or macaque hands in various positions, pictures basically that didn't look very frightening. And what they found was that the images of snakes had a particularly strong and fast-acting effect on the pulvinar neurons. Of the 91 neurons that became active at some point in the experiment, 40% seemed to be very snake-specific. They reacted very quickly and very strongly when these animals saw images of snakes.
So that's in macaques, which are a distant relative to humans. Is there any evidence that this crosses over to people?
No, there's not evidence right now that this actually holds true for people. And one of the experts who chimed in on this news story says that her own work has shown that humans are actually better at detecting cars and guns than they are snakes. And because we really haven't had cars and guns for that long, especially compared to the millions of years with which we've confronted snakes, it suggests that snakes may not be as primal a concern to our modern brains, at least as they used to be.
Next up, we have a story on how allergies may be getting a bad rap. The primary response by the immune system to unfriendly microbes in the body, like bacteria and viruses, is to destroy the intruders. But we also have a second string of defense, the so-called type 2 response, that comes out as allergies. But what we don't know is what exactly this reaction is good for.
Right. Is all that sneezing, coughing, and even sometimes diarrhea good for you? And this new study suggests that it actually is. It has to do with bee stings. And the question was, when people get stung, especially people that are allergic, is that sting somehow protective? Why would we have evolved this response to a bee sting if it's so annoying, basically? And is the idea that perhaps when we get stung once with a bee, it protects us from a potentially lethal sting further down the line?
So how do the researchers actually test whether or not an allergic response might be protective?
What the researchers did is they took a bunch of mice and they gave them an injection of bee venom, not enough to hurt them, but enough to stimulate an allergic response. And then a few weeks later, they injected the mice with a potentially lethal dose of this bee venom. And what they found is that the mice that didn't get that initial sting were not protected, and a lot of them died, but that the mice that did get that initial injection of venom were much more protected, and most of them, in fact, the vast majority of them, survived.
And that was if they had an allergic response to the first.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mice exposed to venom once and then again, and if they had an allergic response, they were protected from a lethal dose. So what does this say about how allergies work in modern times, say, in people? I mean, peanuts have never been lethal as far as I know.
Right. So it's a good question. And what's up with our peanut allergies and some of the other allergies? Well, all of these are also type 2. So it suggests that maybe it's a side effect of this evolutionarily protective effect of this type of allergy. But again, you know, this research was only done in mice, wasn't done in humans. So it's a little unclear about whether this actually holds true for us. So in other words, just because you get that initial bee sting and you're allergic to bees doesn't mean you should stick your hand in a hive anytime soon.
Finally, we have a story on bats as vectors for SARS. After the SARS outbreak in 2002, researchers deduced that the virus passed from bats to civets to humans. But new evidence is suggesting that civets may no longer be needed. So, Dave, can we start back in 2002? Why were civets implicated in this outbreak?
Well, when researchers first started looking for a culprit for the SARS outbreak, they identified a coronavirus in bats, which is very similar to the virus that seemed to be causing SARS in humans. But the bat virus had some important differences with the human virus. Meanwhile, when they looked in civets, they found that the civet SARS virus was much more similar to the virus seen in humans. So their idea was that maybe the bats were biting the civets, and then the civets were transmitting the disease to humans, and therefore the civets were sort of this necessary intermediary between bats and humans.
But this new study suggests that bats may be able to transmit the coronavirus. What kind of evidence did they find?
Well, in the new study, the researchers were looking at bats, and they found two new strains of this coronavirus that were actually much more similar to the human strain that had been seen in the bats about a decade ago. And when they looked more closely at these strains, they found that a spike protein that they encode was actually very similar to the protein that was seen in the virus that directly infects humans. And indeed, when they took these new coronaviruses and they introduced them to cells in the lab, they found that they could directly infect our epithelial cells, which are cells that line our lungs.
Should we be worried about a new SARS outbreak transmitted by bats?
Experts don't think so, at least not based on this evidence alone, because these are just cells in culture. It's not clear that this virus can actually infect human beings. But it is a big concern because even though a lot of people got SARS, hundreds of people died about a decade ago from SARS, the idea was that if it had to go from bats to civets to people, there were a lot of roadblocks the virus had to clear to get to people. But now that there's this idea that it could be transmitted directly from bats to people, and in places like China especially, where people are hunting and eating bats, they have this direct connection with bats. And if bats are able to directly transmit the virus to people, that could be a huge problem. That could potentially spark another pandemic. So the researchers really need to figure out now whether what they're seeing in the lab actually holds true in the real world.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about some new insights into the nature of dark matter. Also tied to Halloween, some very cool pictures of animals that have their own Halloween costumes and wear them year-round. For Science Live, we've got another Halloween-themed story. Our Science Live this week is on the science of fear. Why do we like to get scared? Next week's Science Live is on dark matter, speaking of dark matter. And finally, for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about Superstorm Sandy 1 year later. What impact is it still having on researchers in the U.S. East Coast? Also a story about researchers sparring over tests for breast cancer risk. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site, Science Now. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, our upcoming live chats, and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that concludes the November 1st, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Christy Hamilton. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.